Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Thousands of people have been forced from their homes and more evacuation orders have been issued as the Caldor fire continues to burn in El Dorado County. As of this morning, CAL FIRE reports that the fire has grown to more than 65,000 acres, growing more than 10 times in size in the past 48 hours when it was at roughly 6,500 acres Tuesday morning. The wildfire ignited Saturday near Little Mountain between Omo Ranch and Grizzly Flats. That's south of Highway 50 bordering Amador County. As of right now, there is no containment around the fire. In response, the El Dorado National Forest is under an emergency closure until September 30th. Joining us now is Captain Keith Wade with the Sacramento Fire Department to update us on the latest challenges, and he joins us now. Welcome to Insight, Captain Wade.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're assisting with the Caldor fire, correct?
That's correct. I'm assigned to CAL FIRE's Incident Management Team number 6, and I've been here for a couple of days now as we're working our tails off, if you will, to try to get resources on the ground and really start to contain this incident.
I remember Tuesday morning just checking updates when the Caldor fire was 6,500 acres. And by that afternoon update, the acreage grew to more than 30,000 acres and obviously has since more than doubled in size. What was the fire behavior overnight?
So overnight, we had really moderate fire spread last night, which we were thankful for. The winds during this red flag period have not manifested and impacted us as we anticipated, which is a good thing. Today, though, we are expecting some increased fire activity this afternoon as we're having that more common wind coming out of the southwest. So we're anticipating some fire spread north. And so we're concerned for some spot fires to pop up later this afternoon north and northeast. So operationally, we're just hoping to contain this fire, keep it south of Highway 50. And, you know, that's firefighters that have gotten here. We have increased resources that have now shown up, and we're thankful for them. And we're getting them on the ground in place and really start to work to try to start some containment because we're at 0%.
And when talking about spotting, when checking this morning's update, it did mention that spotting is expected to the north and the northeast. However, the red flag warning expires at 11 a.m. What do you want residents to know?
They need to know that the warnings that have been given, the orders that have been given in these evacuation areas, that this is for their safety. Our primary goal and our focus is public safety at all times. We don't do it just to do it. So it's because this fire is still very active. We're dealing with weather. We're dealing with topography. All these things lend themselves to a very active fire scene, and we can't let our guard down. And they're in this fight with us. So please, everyone, a heightened sense of situational awareness as this fire is big. It has shown itself to be a very active, and we can't anticipate with 100% certainty what's going to happen on a daily basis. So everyone just needs to be ready to shift and have their daily lives interrupted maybe periodically as we're moving through these days and possibly weeks to get this fire fully extinguished.
You know, if I remember correctly, two people have been seriously injured. What can you tell us about that?
So we don't have a lot of information as of yet exactly what occurred, but I can tell you that two civilians who were in a very active fire area did suffer injuries that were rather, you know, severe. So the safety message is this: when we give warnings, it's because we know that people can get injured. We know that people get hurt. We want to keep them safe. We're not doing it just to do it. Again, as I've mentioned earlier, because this is what can occur if people choose to stay in these arenas and think that they can help to fight this fire. They don't have the training and they don't have the experience to know when they need to get out of these areas. And by the time they realize, it can be too late. And so please let the firefighting go to the firefighters and let us do our job and not have to worry about the people staying behind, because that creates a whole nother thing that the firefighters have to deal with, right? That if they're still in these areas and they've chosen not to go, we're obviously going to be concerned for their safety and some of our focus is going to go away from our job of containing and extinguishing the fire. So these people that were injured, we hope that they're recovering well, but I think it's a good lesson and message to the rest of the communities. These areas are dangerous as these fires are taking place, and we want everyone to remain safe.
I think it goes without saying how robust this wildfire season has already been, with months left to go. Firefighters are still working to contain the Dixie Fire north of us. How is this impacting staffing in responding to the Caldor Fire in El Dorado County?
That's a great question. I just met a crew this morning. I was talking to them up in staging, who just arrived today from the Dixie Fire. Dixie Fire's had a lot of resources thrown at it. It's still a very active fire, as you're well aware. They're still issuing evacuation warnings and orders very late into their firefight, but they are scrambling resources down to our incident because Caldor has been a very active fire, and they know that we need help. We were sitting with 250 personnel. We're thankful now that we're up to 650 personnel this morning, and I've been watching engine after engine with names such as Redondo Beach and places, San Diego, with firefighters arriving. And that's what's so wonderful, our mutual aid system here in California, is that neighborly system of when you need help, we're going to be there for you. And we're experiencing that right now.
I mean, just thinking about how relentless this season has been, how are firefighters doing? I mean, you just met firefighters that came off the Dixie Fire, and they're now seamlessly responding to the Caldor Fire.
Yeah, honestly, I could see it in their face. There's a level of them being tired. And that was the same last year. It almost seems as if fire season never ended. And these firefighters are doing an amazing job of staying positive, staying focused. And behind the scenes, we have behavioral health people that are there for them. We're very well aware that we're not superheroes. We're humans just like everyone else. And we're going to experience and see things that will affect and impact all of us just as well as it would affect anyone in the community. So we're making sure we take care of our own. So we have those first responders to the first responders, if you will, available for them, because these are long days, long nights, and the firefight is tough and can be emotionally draining. So, we're there for them as they're there for the whole community together. And it's wonderful to experience that and see it from our point of view. And we truly appreciate everyone who's in this firefight together.
Containment is 0%. And I understand, like, the overwhelming focus is containing this fire. Do you have any preliminary information on what the cause could have been?
No, it's always like that. These investigations are very difficult and they are time consuming. And the focus is always still on of the firefight, because this fire, again, is very active. And as you mentioned, we're at 0% containment. To focus on the investigation so early when we still have such an active fire that is got people removed from their homes, causing damage, possibly the structures and infrastructure, we just have a lot of focus on other areas of importance. But I guarantee you we will visit that investigation at some point to really try to determine what occurred here, what began this fire, where it originated, and hopefully if it was something that was done on purpose or if it was accidental, at least we can identify it so that the public knows.
Do you anticipate expanding evacuation warnings and orders?
So that's always a possibility. We never want to do that. We never want to have people have to leave an area. I would not want to leave my home. And we appreciate that we're in this fight together to try to make sure that people don't have to leave areas. But we will always err on the side of caution when it comes to public safety. And we know from our experience, fire can grow and spread in a moment's notice. We can have things shift. We can forecast as best as possible, but we can't do it with 100% accuracy. Therefore, we will always err on that side of if there's a chance that the fire can go this way, it could impact this community, we are not going to risk these people being injured, and we will make sure that they get that warning, and then when it need be, that order to get out of that area.
Finally, what are the challenges ahead?
Well, the challenges ahead are many. We need to start containment. We need to have enough resources here because this fire is big. So the amount of personnel, the amount of equipment, it's getting here. A lot of it's here now. We can really start focusing on getting these containment lines dug in, starting to build that box around this fire to try to help limit its spread. We're anticipating we're going to have some favorable weather moving forward. And really, it's just going to be a lot of work, and we know we're going to be here a while. We're looking forward to the challenge, so moving forward and getting this community back to normal.
Captain Wade, thank you for taking time with us this morning.
You are very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Captain Keith Wade is with the City of Sacramento Fire Department. He is assisting on the Caldor Fire, which is burning in El Dorado County. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Joining us now is CAP Radio's state government reporter, Scott Rodd. He's been covering the Caldor Fire and evacuations. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks for having me on.
What are evacuees telling you?
Well, morale seems overall to be pretty good among evacuees. I spoke to a number of them who, you know, said that they're feeling, you know, optimistic. They're feeling as though folks are helping each other out in this tough time. I mean, it's, as Captain Wade said, it's very hard when folks are asked to leave their homes. And some are able to go to, you know, friends' homes or stay in hotels, but others have to find somewhere else to stay, whether it's an evacuation shelter or maybe camping somewhere. But the folks I spoke to said that, you know, there really is this sense of community. I spoke to one evacuee, Kelly Moore. She's a longtime resident of Pollock Pines. She was setting up her tent in the parking lot of the Green Valley Community Church. She's familiar with wildfires, and she did prepare to leave. She did prepare early on to leave. Here's what she said.
Yeah, I was ready. I was, when they said it was already hitting Grizzly, I was already packing stuff, and I wasn't going to wait for the order for mandatory evacuation, because if they do it at midnight, you got everybody else in the neighborhood trying to get out in the middle of the dark. You got to leave early. You got to be prepared.
You've lived here your whole life. You've seen fires come through. Has the wildfire situation changed over time?
It has changed so much, because we used to take care of the woods, but now we're having catastrophic fires because we're not taking care of it.
When you're seeing the fires, how are they different from maybe the fires that you saw when you were younger?
They were intense. They were burning thousands of acres, but it wasn't the explosiveness that we're having now.
You've lived here for a long time. Do you foresee staying here?
I've been thinking about moving, but I do love Pollock Pines and Placerville. I mean, I grew up here. This is my home.
You'd mentioned that everyone here has been just very friendly and very
hospitable. Everybody is awesome. We had some guy come in with a whole pickup load of donated cat food, dog food, everything. And then some lady came in with blankets. You know, everybody's pitching in. And that's a really good thing. People are starting to realize we have to take care of each other.
And so while that morale seems to be holding pretty strong right now, a number of people did tell me that they're considering moving, just as Kelly said there. And they said it's for a number of reasons. You know, the increased fire threats, the increased premiums for fire insurance. And also there's a certain responsibility that comes with living in, you know, these beautiful natural areas where you really have to do a lot of upkeep and preparation in order to make sure that you're ready in case a fire comes through, hardening your home, being prepared to leave at any moment. And that's a lot, especially for folks who are older.
Do you have an idea where many of these evacuees are going?
So the evacuation shelters are filling up pretty quickly, especially with COVID rules in place. And that means that each evacuee essentially has to have more space. So the Green Valley Community Church, when I went there, it looked like it was filling up pretty quick. There were a lot of people camping in the parking lot, either in tents or RVs. And it looked like they were, you know, welcome to do that, which is good. The El Dorado Community Center opened as an evacuation site. And as of this morning, they still have availability as well. And as evacuation orders continue, if they continue to grow, you know, local towns and cities are going to continue to try to find areas that can hold them as shelters.
Yeah, on the front end, how do cities and counties plan for evacuations ahead of time?
Well, you know, they err on the side of caution. You know, as your previous guest said, they always you know, don't want to leave it up to chance for anyone to be stuck in a situation where they're in their homes as a fire is approaching. And so they'll issue an evacuation warning or an order well in advance, especially, you know, with a fire like the Caldor Fire, which is, you know, exhibiting extreme fire behavior and at times unpredictable behavior. And so a warning is when is just that. It's a heads up that you may need to evacuate. A lot of emergency officials say even if you get the warning, you should still leave if you feel as though it's the best choice. Better to leave early than later. An order is when it's mandatory. And so, you know, these evacuations are based on the position of the fire, population density, and available evacuation routes. Essentially, they just want to make sure that there aren't any traffic jams getting out and people are able to get to safety as early as possible.
Finally, Scott, this is not your first wildfire this season. You have covered multiple wildfires. What stands out to you about the Caldor Fire?
Well, as I mentioned, the unpredictability is certainly a big part of it. I mean, this fire is exhibiting, you know, just extreme behavior, which is becoming typical for fires this season. Unfortunately, we're seeing it, you know, the Dixie Fire, we're seeing it elsewhere. You know, as your previous guest, Captain Wade, said, you know, these firefighters are working their butts off. I mean, it's pretty incredible to see just how difficult this work is and how they're going at it day after day, both on the ground and also in the air, and in with logistics. So it's a remarkable thing to see. It is sort of troubling to see that there are so many fires popping up right now and that you have personnel pulled between various fires. And it is sort of a flashback to last year where you had crews just running from one blaze to another, and they're taxed, they're exhausted. And so, you know, but they're doing their best out there.
Scott, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Scott Rodd is Cap Radio state government reporter. He is reporting on the Caldor Fire in El Dorado County. Up next, the hazardous air quality is just undeniable. We'll learn why the smoke is worsening COVID-19 cases. And we're joined by Cal State Staneth Law to learn more about the university's decision to delay in-person classes until October 1st. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're becoming uncomfortably familiar with a widespread consequence of wildfires: hazardous air quality. And it's not just a nuisance, from headaches to a scratchy throat. The pandemic adds another harmful layer, and we're getting a clearer picture of the consequences. Last summer, a new study found that severe illnesses and deaths from COVID-19 spiked on the West Coast in the weeks following major wildfires. That study was published in the journal Science Advances. Researchers believe the increase in severity of disease and death seemed to have been aggravated by the smoke during the 2020 wildfire season. Wildfire smoke contains particulate matter that lodge in the deepest part of the lungs. And so you think not only of vegetation, but homes and buildings that are burning. That makes wildfire smoke especially dangerous for respiratory health, compounded with COVID-19, which attacks the lungs. Dr. Vanessa Walker is a pulmonary and critical care physician at the Sutter Roseville Medical Center. Dr. Walker joins us now. Welcome back to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
You know, on this topic, what have you personally seen last summer and even this wildfire season?
Well, anytime we have wildfires in our area, we see increases in people coming in with respiratory complaints, especially those with underlying pulmonary conditions like emphysema, COPD, asthma. And it was really difficult for us to kind of tease out last year. Is this all COVID related, or is there some component to the wildfire smoke? And so when we got this information from this article that you're talking about, it really kind of makes sense. When you look at wildfire smoke exposure, it increases inflammation in the lungs, and it also reduces your immune system's ability to fight diseases. It actually has an effect on suppressing your immune system. So this really makes physiologic sense.
So does the wildfire smoke worsen COVID-19 symptoms, or does it also make us more susceptible to catching COVID-19?
I do think that it's both. You know, having just being exposed to wildfire smoke is going to cause increased inflammation within the lungs, within most people, but especially those that are already more susceptible to having lung inflammation. But looking at studies in the past where we've looked at wildfire smoke exposure, particularly in children, we've actually been able to check the lymphocytes, the T cells in their body, which is a very important part of our immune system function. And those that were exposed to wildfire smoke had a significant decrease in their T cell production and activity. So we know that wildfire smoke is going to inhibit our immune system, therefore making it easier for us to catch any virus, especially COVID, one that is, very easily contracted.
Can you just help us better understand what's in this smoke? Because obviously it's not just trees and vegetation that are burning.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the, anytime you have tree, wildfires, you're not just getting the vegetation, but it's also tearing through barns with chemicals in them or homes and all kinds of cars. So you're getting various chemicals, but we were able to look at comparing studies where they did looking at controlled burns versus wildfire burns. And there was even a distinct difference between a controlled burn of wildfire vegetation and or of a fire, vegetation fires and wildfires. So we are definitely seeing a distinct difference in the type of particulate matter and the amount of chemicals in the air after a wildfire burn. So they are definitely more dangerous than a typical controlled burn.
I personally can attest to that. When I would report on controlled burns, I would feel completely different as opposed to reporting on a wildfire that has gone through a community and actually burned structures down. You can really feel the difference in the smoke when you're out there. And that's such a sobering reality. What should people know? What are some subtle and non-obvious signs that people should be aware of when they're going outside?
Most people don't have lung problems. So, they're really not going to recognize that they're having issues. The biggest things they might feel if they are overly exposed are going to be things like headaches, just generally not feeling well. As you mentioned earlier, scratchy throat or, burning eyes, things like that. But it really is those people that have those underlying conditions that are going to feel it the most. They know what it feels like to not be able to breathe, to have tightness in the chest, wheezing. All of those symptoms can be more pronounced when exposed to wildfire smoke. But then we have to also think about people that may not realize that they're at risk. Pregnant women, they are at risk. It can cause preterm labor and other bad health effects. Children, some we don't know have any lung diseases until they're exposed to wildfire smoke. So it's really everybody needs to be careful when they're outside and try to stay indoors when the air, AQI says the air is unhealthy.
Yeah, I would imagine cloth masks aren't very effective when it comes to particulate matter in wildfire smoke.
So unfortunately, cloth masks or the regular surgical masks are not going to be effective in wildfire smoke. These particulate matter, the 2.5 micron particulate matters are going to go right through those masks. And those are the ones that get deep into the lungs and can enter our bloodstream and cause all the problems that we're talking about. So if you're going to go outside, you need to be outside. You need to wear an N95 mask if you're going to, be outside for prolonged periods of time. And I also just want to add, that does not mean that the masks that we recommend people wearing for COVID are not effective for COVID. So this is a really, hard thing to talk about. People say, well, why is the cloth mask okay for COVID but not okay for wildfire smoke? We're fighting two different things. One is droplets, which are bigger. One is very small particulate matter. So please wear the masks, cloth, or otherwise for COVID. But if you're trying to protect yourself against wildfire smoke, you need that N95.
Thank you so much, Dr. Walker, for all the advice.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Vanessa Walker is a pulmonary and critical care physician at Sutter Roseville Medical Center. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Well, as schools across the state return to in-person classes, one university is taking more of a wait-and-see approach. This week, Cal State University Stanislaus announced the abrupt decision to suspend in-person classes until October 1st. The first day of school is this coming Monday, and classes will now be virtual. Now, the reversal stems from concerning COVID-19 cases in that part of the Central Valley. So to help us better understand the decision-making behind this, we're joined by Ellen June, the president of Cal State Stanislaus. Ellen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You know, this move can be seen as abrupt for students and families planning for the first day of class on Monday. Can you help us guide us through the conversations that were taking place that ultimately led to this decision?
Absolutely. As you all know, the conditions for COVID are fluctuating daily, sometimes hourly, throughout the state. And all parts of the state are not equal. There are significant differences in counties and COVID rates, et cetera. So what we try to do is monitor very closely. Every morning I wake up and sometimes have a pitter-patter in my heart because I look at the COVID cases spiking in our county. Just on Tuesday, we have never seen the kind of cases, even when COVID first announced and there was no vaccine. This past Tuesday was 740 new COVID cases in my county, which is only a smallish county. We only have 550,000 people or so in the county. And that was coupled with the fact that over a 48-hour period, we suddenly had 9 positive COVID cases on my campus of people who had come back. So we had repopulated, staff had come back last Monday, you know, in a phased-in approach. Students were coming back, student workers. These were student workers that were tested, that tested positive. They were coming back to campus to get training, to be all kinds of student ambassadors, you know, social norming, et cetera, for masking, et cetera. So, and faculty were coming back. Classes start on Monday, and faculty, some of them were coming back just to check their offices, check their, classrooms, et cetera. And we saw this sudden spike of 9 cases in 48 hours. And as a consequence, additional 88 people were going in for testing. Some were awaiting their test results currently. So it was a sudden dramatic spike. Those 9 cases in comparison, over the last 18 months, we have one of the lowest COVID cases in the CSU, for example. And so we only had 22 cases of students who were on campus over the entire, stretched out over the entire 18 months. And in addition, another 49 faculty and staff, again, stretched out. They were never clustered in such a dramatic way. So we had to take stock because we're also looking at the data of who and how many students and faculty would return on the 23rd. So roughly of the 2,500 classes that we offer in the fall, a little over 1,064 would be back on campus, face-to-face and or hybrid. And that meant that roughly 5,300 students were coming back onto campus and taking those online on-campus classes. So that if we saw a spike with the small number that were coming in just this last week, you could imagine. I think the other reason that was very concerning for us and for me as the president was that we were we're putting in the highest requirements so that students have to be vaccinated and show documentation, upload a proof of their ID card, their vaccination card or QR code from the county public health, state department, state county health, and they have to show documentation for exemptions for the, for example, medical, and they have to, if they're exempted, they must have testing regularly every week. Students in the dorm and athletes will be required to test if they're exempted twice a week. So we were trying to give students a little bit more time to be able to get fully vaccinated. Full vaccination is not like you can't just get a shot today and be fully vaccinated.
Right, it takes like a month and a half.
Yes, exactly.
For full immunity, yeah.
Right, for full immunity. It's a 5-week time period. And that's why we work backwards to figure out if they were to start today. The students are moving into the dorm. Those who are vaccinated, of our normally 700 dorm spots, 400 are now permitted because we're doing some social distancing, only one student per dorm room. And so 400 students I was over there this morning greeting the students and their parents coming in, those who've been fully vaccinated. And of the 400 moving in, more than about 350 have been vaccinated, so they are allowed to move in. The ones that aren't are, you know, being triaged right now in terms of what the possibilities are. And, you know, we're making different provisions. Some have started their vaccinations, they're not fully. So there's a whole series of processes that they're going through now. And the really amazing part is even with this, you know, unfortunate change in plans of postponing for another 5 weeks, students have been wonderful. I feel badly because so many wanted to start classes in person. About 41% of our courses would be back on campus, so that some of them might not have a full schedule of classes on campus, but at least one or two here and there. And so the part of this is because 74% of my students are first in their family to get a college degree. Here in the Central Valley, many students are place bound and want to stay local to keep the costs down. And so they were so excited to try and experience what college life was like. So we are doing videos, we are doing messaging, social media as well, to let students know that we are so excited for them to come back, but we won't do it until it's safe. And until we can guarantee that everyone on campus is vaccinated or getting tested if they're exempted, then we'll be safe to create kind of a bubble of safety on campus. Masking will be required in all indoor classrooms. We've improved all of the ventilation systems. Speaking of all the fires, because of the fires last year, we also upgraded all of the filters in our buildings, increased the air exchange with the external air, which obviously cannot be done during you know, hazardous fire air quality conditions, and enhanced our cleaning protocols, all of those things in preparation. So we've been preparing very, very, you know, strenuously for this fall. And now we're just going to postpone until we get all of this information to be able to be logged in to a secure online platform. And we're ready to go, watching daily and consulting with all of the groups on campus on the criteria that we'll use to determine when it's safe to come in. I will say that I made provision for if there are conditions under which there's specific courses or faculty who rely more on face-to-face. For example, I'm just saying, let's say sculpture, hard to teach online, or pottery, you need a kiln, all those kinds of things. So under those circumstances, they can petition and work closely with our health department and our infectious disease coordinator. And then we can ensure that all the students in their classes are vaccinated. Then some of those classes can start earlier than the October 1st deadline. And so these are all things that are, you know, we're trying to implement, because one size doesn't always fit all. And we want to be sensitive and responsive to the, you know, changing health conditions and, you know, to our campus community.
Yeah, Ellen, before we let you go, in the last minute or so that we have, do you know if these discussions are happening at other CSU campuses? I mean, the Cal State University system is the largest four-year university system in the country.
That's correct. Every president, and I'm just so fortunate, we have an amazing system office, the chancellor's office, as well as all the 22 other amazing, wonderful colleagues that I have. So we meet regularly. And every campus is unique. So just as an example, remember, you know, at some of the counties, the vaccination rates, or even San Francisco, I was hearing very strong, upwards of 90% are vaccinated in the city, not necessarily in the county. And then the same is true for other larger population centers. So our campus in Stanislaus County is among the worst in terms of vaccination rates. 60% of people in my county are not vaccinated. And the behaviors of people also contribute to this. So we see great spikings because, like on Tuesday, after the weekend, we see spikes. And so in my county alone, on the 17th, this past Tuesday, 740 new cases. We have never seen spikes like that before. And again, because people are not wearing masks, they're not doing social distancing, they're not being careful, especially over a weekend, and these spikes occur. So every campus is really monitoring all of their data very carefully. And all of us must work individually with our county health offices, because they will serve as guiding posts in helping us make those decisions and supporting any decision that any other president might make. So yes, we're having those discussions, but every county, every CSU has very different demographics and considerations. So what happens at one place does not foretell what's going to happen at another location.
Right. Ellen, thank you for spending time with us this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us.
Ellen June is the president of Cal State Stanislaus and discussing plans to hold off on in-person instruction until October 1st. Classes until that date will be virtual. Still ahead, we say farewell to CAP Radio healthcare reporter Sammy Cayola and look back on her important work in Northern California. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Insight is a place for conversations about what's happening in our community, our region, and across the country. And today, that includes some news within our CAP Radio newsroom. Joining us now is Sammy Cayola, CAP Radio's healthcare reporter. She joined the station's news team in 2017, and the big news is that after years of serving Northern California, Sammy is leaving CAP Radio. So we just want to take a few minutes to celebrate Sammy and her time here at the station. Sammy joins us now. Welcome.
Hey, Vicki. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Oh, we are so lucky to have you at CAP Radio and just really looking forward to the next chapter in your life. You know, you joined CAP Radio in 2017 after being at the Sacramento Bee for 3 years. I mean, what was that transition like, you know, with hindsight, going from print to radio?
It was very strange. I had wanted to be a newspaper woman from the age of about, 10. And so I spent my whole life as a writer, and I didn't have any experience in radio whatsoever. But, you know, the world was changing by the time I was ready to leave the Bee. Jobs in print were hard to find. People were getting laid off. And I was already covering healthcare for the Bee, and I saw that CAP Radio had a health position open. And I thought, okay, here's the time to change and to try to acquire a new skill set. But it was a really difficult transition. I will say my first few months of producing radio were not pretty. I would do things like forget to turn on my recorder or go record someone in direct wind. And I want to give a huge shout out to everybody at CAP Radio who helped me learn the ropes, especially Julia Mitrich, who is a former staffer, Randall White, who's a current staffer. We have some audio gurus in our newsroom, and I was really able to lean on them. And, you know, ultimately, I still get to write a ton for CAP Radio, for capradio.org. And I think our combination of digital and audio storytelling is really the best way to reach audiences.
Yeah. You know, as a healthcare reporter, I mean, obviously you focus on issues like also mental health and trauma and access to healthcare. But like all of us, you got some curveballs during this year, especially or in the last 3 years or 4 years, especially during the pandemic. How did that change how you reported on issues in our community?
You know, I was cleaning out my desk at the station yesterday where, you know, I haven't been there for more than a year. And I was going through all these notes from all these stories that were not about COVID-19. It's like, wow, look at all these issues I used to cover because I used to write about, you know, people's insurance plans, surprise billing, hospital business decisions, and access to Medi-Cal, you know, a lot of that sort of wonky healthcare stuff. But I also was always interested in what we call the social determinants of health. So the neighborhoods people live in, their access to green space, where they find healthy food, what microaggressions they face on a daily basis. And that all really came into play for me after the shooting of Stephon Clark, where we started to really think about what was going on in our community and who was facing these adverse health effects. And that's something that I've just kind of always carried with me, is how, you know, small, maybe underserved communities, not even small, you know, they make up a huge part of our population, but they're just not getting the resources, right, that they need to. And so that's just always a lens that I've taken to healthcare. And I was thinking about just covering public health. So a long time ago in Sacramento, I was covering Ebola, which had hit Sacramento's Liberian community. And I was talking to people who were really afraid for their families over there and people who were, you know, trying to figure out whether they could travel. But that was on a very small scale. And when the pandemic hit, you know, on its face, it's a public health story. It's okay, a disease is spreading. What needs to happen to stop it? But on a much deeper level, you know, it's a human story about the way that we live and work and play. And, you know, for many communities, it was a story of grief. And it was a story of really fear, stress, and sadness. And so I think off the bat, you know, the whole CAP Radio team wanted me to focus on isolation and anxiety and just how we kind of cope through this moment. And we talked a lot about what boat are you in? Like, there's a storm coming. Are you in like a big sturdy boat, or are you in like a small rickety boat, you know, and you're going to have a harder time depending on where you are in Sacramento and what resources you have. Right. And so I think the angles we took on the pandemic and are continuing to take on the pandemic are those that highlight communities that are experiencing this in a more difficult way. And we're trying to hold city, county, and state officials, you know, to account for the responsibility they have to help those communities. And so I'm just thinking, we covered Latinx families, you know, who faced great loss this year. We talked about parents of children with disabilities whose kids were out of school. I looked at nursing homes and seniors who were in isolation. So yeah, I think our pandemic coverage has evolved and will continue to.
You know, being a journalist is far from just a 9-to-5 job. It's a calling and it's a passion. I always liken it to like it's another appendage for me. You know, it's very much ingrained in our identity as individuals. How have you changed as a reporter and as a person during this time?
That's a great and difficult question. I think when I started at CAP Radio, I was like the rookie in the newsroom. I felt like everyone had been there forever and I was brand new. Now I'm, you know, the reporter who's been there almost the longest. And yeah, it's just, I feel like I've been on the health beat for 7 years. So now I have some expertise and people sort of lean on me a lot to say, hey, you know, what do you think about this? And it still feels strange to me because I still feel like I'm learning all the time. But yeah, it's just made me a more confident journalist. And I've had so much support at CAP Radio. I've had amazing editors like Chris Hagan, who we're going to hear from soon. And shout out to Nick Miller, our managing editor of news, because I've just been able to build a lot of confidence. And also creating the podcast, which you're going to hear about soon, was such a capstone for me. It was something I'd been wanting to do for years. And so it just feels like it's come a long way. And I'm really grateful.
Well, on that note, let's bring in Chris Hagan. He's CAP Radio's managing editor of digital content. You know, Chris, you both joined the station at the same time in 2017. When editing Sammy's digital pieces that people read on capradio.org, what were some of the things that stood out to you about her reporting?
Yeah, I mean, I think Sammy beat me to CAP Radio by about 2 weeks. So she has been at CAP Radio the whole time I've been there. But yeah, I mean, what really has stood out to me is, you know, just what you mentioned, the reporting, like that is the thing that transfers no matter whether you're doing radio or digital or anything. It's, you know, Sammy is a great reporter. One of the things that stood out to me, and I'm guessing evidence of that was in her desk when she cleaned it out, was that when we were in the office together, you would watch Sammy fact check her stories. She would print them out. She would grab different colored highlighters. She would have a different color for the facts, the names, the numbers, and she would go through each of those. And as an editor, it was always great to see that. Every reporter has their own fact-checking process, but Sammy's was very visible and colorful. And so that always gave me a lot of confidence when editing her work. And then, you know, the other thing, again, like she just has a ton of expertise in healthcare. We were really lucky to be able to work together on a project with USC about Californians without health coverage, and especially undocumented Californians without health coverage. And as part of that project, we went around to different sites in Sacramento and talked to different people at clinics and hospitals. And everywhere we went, everybody knew Sammy. And not only did everybody know Sammy, but they respected her. When she walked in the room, she was a rock star because of the reporting she had done and the expertise and the trust she had built in the healthcare community in Sacramento. And so, as she mentioned, we lean on her because she knows everyone. She knows almost everything. Obviously, we're always learning everybody. But when we have a question about healthcare in Sacramento, we can ask Sammy. And if she doesn't know, she knows the person to call and ask.
Yeah. Well, let's also bring in Emily Zentner. That's CAP Radio's data reporter. Emily and Sammy work so closely together on the After the Assault podcast. Emily, I mean, just tell us a little bit about what it's been like to work with Sammy.
I mean, Sammy's the best. We've worked on this project, I think, for about a year and a half together, and it's hard to work with anyone for that long. But I think Sammy's one of the easiest people to work with because she's just always, you know, willing to meet another person where they are and make things work, and is, you know, just a kind person. And getting to see Sammy work with our survivor cohort for After the Assault, and just her patience and her kindness and her willing to kind of put her ego aside and figure out how to do this really hard work with them in a way that was safe, and, you know, also in her role as a journalist, was really amazing. And yeah, I just am really impressed with Sammy as a person and a journalist, and I think all of that combines together to make her a really great reporter.
You know, Sammy, when talking about all of and remembering all of the accomplishments and all of the powerful projects that you've done here in Northern California, I mean, one of them, you had the opportunity to actually interview Dr. Fauci through the Sacramento Press Club. What was that experience like?
It was so nerve-wracking and also so exciting. I mean, he was all over the news even at that time. This was June 2020. Things were really confusing. People had all kinds of questions, and we had the nation's top expert at our disposal. So I was really nervous, but he was really, really nice. Here's a clip.
Face coverings. Our statewide health orders ask people to wear them, but we're seeing lots of people are not doing that. What sorts of messaging can elected officials or public health officials put out to get people to comply?
Well, that's why I'm here on your show with you, is to really do exactly that. There's no doubt. I mean, I think there was some confusion about masks in the beginning, and it's unfortunate it gave a mixed message. It was at a time when personal protective equipment, including masks, were in short supply, and it was clear that the people who really needed them were the healthcare workers who bravely put themselves in harm's way at a risk to take care of people with COVID disease. Now we have plenty of masks, and we know that cloth coverings can work as well as some masks. So everybody should wear a mask when out in public. Keep 6 feet distance. Don't congregate.
And just a reminder, that is still the advice.
Yeah, right.
We still need everyone to wear a mask. Sadly, many things have not changed. But yeah, that is certainly a highlight for my career at Cap Radio. And, you know, just loved talking to him. He's from New York and so am I. So we got to have some bonding off the bat.
Yeah, we got about 2 minutes left, and I think we have time to play a clip from After the Assault. And for all listeners, you can listen to the podcast right now. It is incredible and incredibly powerful. I don't know, Sam, if you want to quickly kind of set up and introduce what we're going to listen to.
Yeah, I'll just say that, you know, this series is about sexual assault survivors who they may choose to go to law enforcement, they may not, but this is about what the aftermath of sexual violence is like. And I got really close to 8 different survivors, and you'll hear me introducing some of that right now.
But Jessa, who you heard from at the beginning of this episode, got a little bit further into the maze of the criminal justice system. Her case was handed off to a detective, and she heard back from that detective pretty promptly. She spent 10 months working with detectives at the police department.
It's been like a second job.
I'm trying to put myself in Jess's shoes here. We all know that familiar feeling of waiting for an email to come in. Imagine constantly checking your phone or your inbox for an update on your case, maybe while you're working full-time or trying to raise a child. It's a constant pull at your attention. It's this low-level stress about the status of your case. And for a lot of survivors, that sense of feeling powerless makes it hard for them to work through their trauma. Here's Jessa again.
When I think about it, I get really, really frustrated having to deal with every step of the way, like having to call, you know, the sergeant and having make it very clear it was not a priority. And then having to call the detective when it finally got, you know, the case assigned, and like they were kind of condescending each time when they'd explain stuff, but I just pushed through. I'm like, okay, well, this is what I'm explaining. And like, okay, you know, and every time I just try to have to let go of that conversation and just next step, like it's just forward. I'm not dwelling on this stuff. But then you stop after, you know, it's been like over a year now since they told me that they weren't really going to do anything with the case and then it'll just sit there. All this stuff that I did, everything they wanted, I did it. Like, I worked so hard and went nowhere. It is infuriating.
So as you can tell, you know, these survivors really have been through a journey. They're still on a journey. And we had to work hard to get really close to them and gain their trust. It's a big part of doing this project. I want a quick shout out to Jessica Maria Ross, who leads community engagement for the station. And she really, you know, created the strategy that allowed us to report this project as thoroughly as we did. So it was an incredible experience for me. And thank you for letting me highlight it, Vicki.
Sammy Kayola is CAP Radio's healthcare reporter. We will miss you and lots of luck on the PCT.
Thanks.
And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is CAP Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday.